Well, I'm on the line with activist Brent Adams. It's about 5:20 on Saturday afternoon. That's the 24th of February. Hi, Brent.
Hello.
And, of course, I heard from your announcement that the Santa Cruz Warming Center is not open. Watsonville is tonight?
No, we retooled that. That was outgoing yesterday.
Ah.
No warming centers tonight. We have a strong likelihood of opening in Watsonville only on Monday. Nothing in the foreseeable future in Santa Cruz.
So the last time we talked, or maybe it was the time before, you said that though you'd done a lot of prep, you've only really felt the conditions were ripe for opening the center on three nights this winter. What's been your total so far now?
I think we're at eight now.
Oh, so there's been a lot of cold lately. That I've noticed myself.
Yeah, we've been bopping along. I think we also had an opening or two, and we didn't really put the word out strongly on the interweb.
You may have read the article in the Sentinel. I think it was either today or yesterday, regarding the Wednesday Santa Cruz neighbors meeting with Chief Mills, Police Chief Mills, Martin Bernal, and other officials of the city, where, I don't know, cranky citizens, as I would describe them, were sort of grilling officials, including Susie O'Hara, about the Boneyard, now renamed the River Street campground, or mini campground, if you will. Have you read that article?
Yeah, including Rainey Moore and Carlos Palacios of the county.
Right, the county with their many plans and few actual results. At least that's my impression. What do you make of that article? We can sort of get general impressions, and then we can get to specifics, maybe.
First of all, I think it was interesting. It sounded like I was not there. I wanted to be there. I was busy. Deborah Ellison, starting the meeting off, according to the article, asking what the county is going to do. These are city talking points. I would wish that a community group would have asked more pointed questions about it's really funny how far we've come along. I shouldn't be complaining because this is a conversation I wanted to see years ago and I wanted to be up in it. I'm completely out of it. So always I'll just express my sense of sour grapes because I think we could do this so much better with much more savvy at a lower cost and in bringing community together in a stronger way rather than just having the city be a contractor and running a homeless camp. Very bizarre turn of events. I'm still trying to figure it out, but that article, according to the meeting, Santa Cruz neighbors at the police community hall, seemed to be more about funding. Firstly, what's the county going to do? Interestingly, the county that has so much more money than the city does is earmarking almost no money, a very small amount of funding, but they express that their funding is locked up in health and human services, which I believe it is. They have to go through, more gyrations to free up money. But it's surprising they don't have a supermassive general fund, though, for things like this.
So one thing that alarmed me or that concerned me, and it probably alarmed me too, was the statements which I think it's Jessica York, who did the article.
Yep.
I've got it here.
Yep.
Which she quotes Mills as saying that the closing of the San Lorenzo campground, which is scheduled for Wednesday, I guess.
Yeah, the 28th, coming up soon.
Is going to be sort of to the signal for... Well, first of all, clearing people away from there, he says, quote, he says, we're shutting off the benchlands. Nobody's going to camp there, Mills said. If we have to sit there all night in a teepee, making sure that people aren't going to camp there, that's what we're going to do. That has become a spot we no longer want people being there, and that's bad enough. But he adds, or at least I guess he's paraphrased by Jessica York. Once the River Street camp opens, Mills said he will be able to refer people to a specific location when they are seen sleeping publicly. Without that, he said, his hands have been tied as played out in court rulings elsewhere in the state. What's your reaction to that?
I think he's cramming a couple things together. Maybe he's talking about Bell versus Boise and the sleeping ban that he's been noted to speak about. And as you and I would note, rather welcomingly over, you know, in relating to the last police chief, and yet kind of hinting that the suspension of the camping ban might see its end. I don't know. What do you read into that?
Interestingly enough, I read the opposite. Of course, for those who don't know, Bell versus Boise was not really a court decision, but a sort of an advisory opinion from the feds a couple of years ago supporting a lawsuit up in Idaho, and it didn't really, I don't think it's gotten very far yet, but, you know, we heralded it at the time as a big deal. I wasn't completely impressed.
No, but what do you think, what court cases do you think he's indicating?
Well, there are a couple things. I mean, first of all, I think he's talking about the Jones decision down in Los Angeles in 20.
Right, let me refer to that. Yeah, you're right.
And the Jones decision, and of course the Spencer decision that followed in San Diego, which have to do with, if you ain't got the shelter, you can't arrest the people, is sort of the quick summary of that. But also, more recently, there's a federal judge who has been stalking about in the Santa Ana riverbed campground, essentially insisting that anyone who is moved from that campground area be given 30 days in a motel and additional social services. And when the sheriffs come in and say, you know, we're going to check you for warrants, he starts saying, no, no, no. And he dresses them down and says, you're sending in social workers first to actually provide at least for 30 days lodging and then, you know, a pathway to something based upon, I think he says, the fact that they got millions of dollars that they're hoarding, which is often the case with these big cities. I guess Oxnard and those places in Orange County are big cities. But, you know, the problem that I see with it, what Mills says is that he seems to imply when he says he'll be able to refer people to a specific location when they are seen sleeping publicly. Without that, he said, his hands have been tied as played out in court rulings. In other words, he had to, in the past few months, allow people to sleep on public property because he had no place to supposedly send them.
Oh, I see. So continue. I'm sorry.
Right. No, I mean, I think you're catching on what I'm saying. This was the ruse used by police in the Pottinger case way back in 1998-99 in Florida, in Dade County. I believe it was Dade County. I could have the wrong county, but, you know, all these Florida counties would confuse me. But what they found, the Pottinger decision was a decision by Clyde Atkins, a federal judge way back when, that said, first he set up safe zones for the homeless in 1992 because he said you can't arrest them without giving them a place to sleep because people have to sleep. It's, you know, unconstitutional to deny them the right, which we kind of, we don't take it for granted now, but that has become more current. Then in 1998, he essentially said, unless there's adequate shelter, you can't arrest them. And so what that resulted in was a much more visible presence in homeless people, and they built more shelters. And I think they even had a campground or two, Tent City or two.
So where I'm reading that he might again be enforcing the sleeping ban.
Yes.
That you're saying that his hands are tied. He's, because of these court decisions, he's unable to enforce the sleeping ban. But it just doesn't. So the question is, there's nothing in that article that indicates then what?
Well, no, I'm saying that I don't. He says, now, this is my interpretation. I can enforce the sleeping ban now that the River Street campground has been set up, supposedly the 12.
Oh, I see. That gives them an out legally.
Right. In other words, the San Lorenzo Park might not have been an out because it wasn't legally set up and everybody was angry about it, or some right-wingers were angry about it. Now they've got this, you know, this desiccated, you got to be, driven up there. I call it a barbed wire place because it is a barbed wire place. I keep going by it.
The barbed wire for me is inconsequential. That was pre-existing.
I know, it was, but they haven't removed it. And
well,
I guess,
I mean, we use symbolic things like that to mean a lot. It's just a city courtyard, a fallback location. The barbed wire is great for uses for people like you, but I don't want to call too much attention.
Yeah, I'm not saying you. This is my opinion.
Actually, if I were going to do a sanctuary type camp, in the way we were going to do it, you could still point to the barbed wire, but it's not about the barbed wire. It's simply about the definable space where you have an entrance where you can,
Well, it's also about access, and it's also about rules, and it's also about,
sure.
all kinds of other things, which I don't think they may have taken, they've, cribbed a few things.
You need some rules.
Well, it's about the specific rules that are involved,
yes.
You know, and I think that, and also it's about the phony claim that this then becomes the justification for reinforcing the sleeping ban.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying, I think. At least that's
that's what I read, too.
Yeah. So I think we unfortunately agree on our assessment because it's, and I wish it weren't true, and maybe it's not. Maybe York has it wrong. I would like to hear, you know, a tape of the meeting. I actually announced that this meeting was happening at the Huff meeting on Wednesday, but none of us got to it. We were all preoccupied with other stuff. We are meeting next week on Wednesday to try to be present when the, you know, they declare the deadline on the San Lorenzo campground to go out there. I take it you're probably going to be around, keeping an eye on things.
Oh yeah, I'll have all of my decks clear of data and collecting as much video as I can for the process. Partially, you know, I'm intrigued about the the establishment of the encampment. Of course, that's something again that I think I'm an expert on. I know why they work, why they don't work, where these dozens of places are. I'm dying to talk about it with people within the city government of the city that I call home, and run a nonprofit in. And yet, it's so bemusing. You know what I mean? I'm just like, wow, this is really spectacular and bizarre. You know, again, you and I looking at the scene over decades and that the city's doing something like this. On one hand, I just want to, I have a shit-eating grin. I'm like, this is amazing. I didn't see this coming. So on the other hand, I think they're doing it stupidly. In fact, you read the article, anytime there's a pointed question about the specificity of a type of encampment, how you're running it, the platitudes, the hollow phrases from Rainey Marr, from Susie O'Hara about rules, about how these things are run, who they're going to choose. She says it's self-selecting. It is not self-selecting. You have to go into it with a strong purpose around, you have a pre-existing population of people who sleep outside in this community. There are people with physical immobilities and mental health challenges, and people who automatically, if they're going to use this VSPADAT vulnerability index that we've been invested so much in, then why the fuck don't we use it to find out who is most appropriate, who mostly needs it, not...
Explain the vulnerability index you're talking about, Brent.
Well, this is an industry standard through the HUD for permanent supported housing to determine who should get HUD funding in towards, and we should put in. Now, in Santa Cruz, 180-2020, 180-180 historically, our local version of the Housing First, it's called permanent supported housing locally, getting people off the street into housing. It's a federal program. I don't want to go too much into it, but they were using the VSPADAT, that's an acronym, I don't know what it stands for, it's a vulnerability index to determine, first of all, what a chronically homeless person is. I think it's like up to, 2 years on the street, medical need, or I'm forgetting what the term is actually, disabling conditions. And so if you rank, like if you're old enough, that gives you a rank. If you have a mental health issue, that gives you a rank. If you have a physical disability, that gives you a rank. So ideally, to rank high on the vulnerability index, you have two disabling conditions and you're older. That means they would put you immediately into shelter. As we know, just walking up and down the street, that has been ignored. Walkers and wheelchairs and elderly people fucking everywhere. What they did was pick for success. They picked people who were not vulnerable, but who would be more easy to house. And so for all the platitudes of the Housing First 180-180, 180-2020, Phil Kramer, head up his ass sort of character, they lied to us. Anyway, so when you have I'm sorry, that was a little brutal. I should chill out.
They're never going to talk to you now, Brent. Go ahead.
So you heard me, Phil. He knows. The idea that an encampment would be self-selecting, whatever the fuck that means, and that the rules when they talk about rules, they don't even know what they're talking. They act like they've never seen a program like this. This is really easy stuff to grok. A community like this has very basic a list of agreements that are uniformly spread over dozens of these encampments run by nonprofits, especially Eugene and Seattle are the hallmarks, and Sanctuary Camp in Santa Cruz have been talking about this for years. Even just basically the warming center has these specific agreements that Susie O'Hara cannot even list the first of them, like no theft, no violence, no use of substances in the space. She still hasn't even uttered one sentence indicating that she even knows those basic, like, you know, concepts. It's not about anyway. So I'm a little frustrated. Also,
Before you go into the next thing, I mean, I think that she is there. She's probably going to come out with a list of these things come March 1st whenever they open this thing up.
Yeah, you'd think.
I mean, I think they will, but I think it's not necessarily going to have. To me, the whole thing is a little Potemkin village kind of thing, which is, you know, what they did in the Soviet Union.
Why don't you define that?
Potemkin village was a thing used, as I understand it, in the Soviet Union that they showed to, sympathizers who came over from different countries to see how life was wonderful for people, even who are being held in detention camps. Because in a way, that's what this is. It's a detention camp. You know, I mean, as to say, it's a place where normal adult behavior and rules do not apply. You can't really come and go as you wish, although Susie O'Hara insists that you can, that they will have, she doesn't call it limousine service, but she says you're going to have to be transported to and from on the shuttle, as you've mentioned before, as I have as well, and as is mentioned by her in her presentations to city council. But she also insists if anybody wants to leave during the day, or stay during the day, they can stay and they can leave, then there will be transportation provided them. Now, to me, that sounds highly unlikely, or I'm not sure, you know, how she intends to do this. She's not going to let you walk out because you have to, you know, you risk violating their rules, which involve walking up to and from the shelter itself.
Well, shockingly, I believe with Community Bridges, which is the most expensive transport out there, which is, you know, they're highly expensive shuttle. I don't think that's appropriate at all.
Can you hold for a second? Brent, can you hold for a second?
Yeah.
Don't go away. Yeah. So you were saying that the shuttle is expensive.
Yeah, it's expensive. I think that Community Bridges is highway robbery, the amount that they charge for these contracts. That's why we're really disgusted about the budgeting of this sort of thing at $90,000 a month. I believe they're contracting for 4 months, but as we know that the way the mission creep of the encampment and the likelihood of them actually setting up a navigation center or an interim phase two is highly unlikely when they're spending this kind of bread.
Explain. Let's remind the community that this is supposedly this River Street encampment at 1220 River Street, opening March 1st and then closing, what, June 30th or something, is supposedly part of a three-part plan, which their presentation at City Council said the second part would begin in June of 2019. And I think O'Hara claimed in an email to me that it was rather going to start in June of 2000 or July of 2018, and that was an interim navigation center that you mentioned, which is some sort of somewhat better but still highly managed program modeled on the San Francisco or San Diego model or San Francisco model, to be followed by a permanent building which might be located somewhere near the homeless lack of services center, which had wanted to have nothing to do with this project, as I understand it.
Yeah, they've got, it's a fruit salad of apples and oranges all mixed together in a way that seems like an administrative management, program creation nightmare, where you've got one thing. I mean, like, if they get the encampment up and running and it's going smoothly, I will tip my hat. If they get any other funding, as they were indicating, Chris Monteith told me in a personal conversation that he's contracted for 4 months and then he's out. That's the encampment. So that extends into, I guess, July, if we're saying March, April, May, June. No, that's end of June, mm-hmm. Right? So, managing that. So then in the next 3 months, 4 months, they're going to be trying to hustle and get this new phase two interim navigation center. It's not clear. They still haven't uttered what a navigation center means to them. Most people, I've been to many cities, and they indicate the term navigation center like San Francisco, they say. They've never been there. They can't tell you what it is. The idea is it's just this sort of catch-all, feel-good thing that everyone's going to go in there and we're going to be able to solve all their problems. The question is, with what tools, with what housing, what transitional housing? In San Francisco, it hit the wall. They did have some transitional housing. Google or some still mysterious mega corporation ponied up the first $3 million to get it started, and it was orchestrated by, I guess, the Presbyterian Church. They opened three. Now they're opening more, because what's true is they found that getting people off the street, the visuals of that, as we say, they don't care how you do it, just get them off the street. But because, of course, it's become an uber gentrified city, and you cannot, they just don't want to see the visual trappings of homelessness on the street. Santa Cruz is getting a bit like that. So this idea that we're going to put people behind, as you say, a barbed wire fence up River Street, and then move them into a type of, quote, navigation center that they still can't define, is really just to kind of purge and clean the streets. But they have not described what that means. And I would like them to know where the that's what we should be asking. So you're going to piss away this $90,000 a month into this encampment, which is really, poorly budgeted. And then where's the funding going to come from this navigation center? That's what I really want to know.
You know, I kind of wonder what the cost has been of Parks and Rec enforcement of the San Lorenzo campground. I suspect it's been much less.
Well, I think that, the way city budgeting works is they don't ever itemize it for us that way. These guys are all on staff anyway. They move people from here and there, and they just, they claim they're not budgeting up for it. But if they put so much, you're right. They've put a lot of resources into that encampment, and we would like to know what that amounts to.
Well, I'm suggesting I think it's far less than they're throwing at this smaller, I think far less usable and far less appealing campground.
Well, I don't know, Robert, because
I don't either.
You can go into that encampment at almost any time during the daytime and see a park ranger on foot or in a car. You'll see three of them at once. Sometimes you'll see a powwow when they do the camp cleanups. Imagine the profound cost of having literally over a dozen parks workers and all of the rangers engaged in that. That's 2-3 days in a row, and then including law enforcement. I think the price tag is actually pretty high, I would estimate.
Well, I mean, I don't know if they're hiring new people. I mean, they're not hiring people at $17 an hour like they are at this upcoming River Street campground, the Boneyard campground.
Well, you know what they did is a year ago, nine months or so ago, they indicated they were going to it was after the Joey Schumacher murder, actually a year and a half ago, on the river levee, the Parks Department was given the ability to hire many more workers to police the levee, but it turned out they never had to do that. And so I think they had a lot of extra resources to give to the park that they would have been putting on the levee. They were going to have a constant presence, if you recall, constant presence on the levee, which it turns out they don't have to do because the levee is since the encampment. When they closed the levee to traffic, with the signs, you can't access the river at all, nor are you really allowed to even touch the dirt or the hillside.
You better not linger on the paths also.
West side, yeah. But they don't, but they never really did staff up, because people just moved away from the levee is what they did. It turned out they didn't have the problem for a while at the footbridge. And every once in a while, of course, you get the person sleeping overnight. But so I think they ended up with an extra budgetary thing. They probably, I don't know about. But what I truly want to know is this $90,000, and they're going to tap out. They save the general fund in 3 months. They'll be out. I don't know if that's true. They want to reach out to community business partners, they'll likely use Chip from the Downtown Business Association, who's been very instrumental in the Downtown Streets team. We know the Downtown Streets team is going to have first dibs in terms of those host positions within the encampment. I've heard already that a lot of street team people are getting residency within the encampment. That blows your vulnerability index. They're going to get first dibs. People in wheelchairs and walkers are going to remain downtown. But I want to know where the money's coming from. I want to hear anything about this.
I catch your point here, but I gotta say, first of all, to me, this is such a, as I call it, Potemkin Village token effort. I mean, for you, it's remarkable, and I suppose, if I want to be...
Well, because I want to see this long-lasting. We have sanctuary-type camps in every city of this county enduring.
I don't see this as being really an experiment to really try and do that. I think it has to do...
Nor do I.
Right, and the problem is it's the pretext for cracking down everywhere else in the city and going after the destruction of survival camps everywhere else that currently exist, and that's what I'm afraid is going to happen. But let me ask you what people are saying about this River Street encampment, because last time we talked, you told me you were working on a survey that didn't really include questions so much about that, but you were also, you had some informal contacts with people about what they think about this upcoming 1220 River Street place to go to.
So, like my role in the administrating the Warming Center program, I'm constantly indicating all other opportunities for people without judgment. I don't tell people I'd like or dislike the winter shelter when I'm trying to tell people who need shelter about it, right? So people who are sleeping on the street who need something a little better, I am indicating to them, do you know about this 1220 River Street? And do you know that, if you really need shelter, get in line for that. Whether I think it's positive or negative, it's better, in my view, than what I see in a lot of circumstances, like some of the people living along the tracks in the Harvey West neighborhood that I've come to become more familiar with, finally, that are very vulnerable people. So I asked them, do you know about it? A lot of people have no clue. A lot of people in the Harvey West neighborhood haven't heard anything about this, so they're likely not going to be giving an opportunity to be there, even though it's just, a quarter mile from where they're sleeping on the tracks right now. People downtown, some of them have heard about it. Like I said, people in the streets team all know about it. That's, again, for me, that's a huge red flag. But what
are people telling you about it in terms of those who have, I catch that people haven't heard much about it, but for those who have heard about it, you said 50% are interested, 50% aren't. Any new accounts or stories, and also any reports on how encampments are being treated elsewhere in town and in San Lorenzo up to now?
Yeah, so when you go into the current Benchlands encampment, there has been zero outreach for this encampment to this point. That is stunning to me. By now, there should already have been an outreach to invite people into the encampment. If they're going to start it as soon as just a week from now and closing the encampment in the Benchlands within the next 3 days, one would think that they would have surveyed and already have a list of people that they're considering for this encampment, if not wholesale move, like we want everybody to from this encampment to let, to feel welcome, and that these are the parameters and this is how you sign up. Where is that process, Robert? That is shocking to me.
So how much time have you been spending out there, Brent? Maybe they've been doing it on the sly when you weren't there.
I'm there every day. I was there this morning hanging out at 7:30 after the Warming Center in Watsonville. I came down to visit. A couple days ago, my bike was stolen. It was refound within the encampment. That's its own interesting story. And I asked people regularly, are you going to the encampment at 1220 River Street? And most of them in the San Lorenzo Park either say they're interested or they're definitely not, but none of them have been invited.
Uh-huh. How are conditions...
Robert, doesn't that sound bizarre to you that this is the fall, the new place that people are going to be going to from, ideally, And yet they haven't really been informed about it officially?
Well, unless you have a federal judge stalking up and down, directing these agencies to do it under threat of, you know, injunctive relief, I don't think you're going to get it. Because, as I said, I think this is a mask for simply cracking down on people elsewhere in the city and also, you know, throwing some red meat to the Take Back Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz neighbors.
But I just want to know who it's going to be.
Who's going to
sign up for the encampment? How will they get in touch with the information?
I don't think they care about that. I think what they care about is, see, we have this show encampment. Oh, you're not going to it. Okay, we can give you tickets and drive you away and confiscate your property.
Oh yeah, but you would think, here's what I would believe, that they're going, that the, all of this money and all of this effort must show up in some visual shift on in street homelessness, the visual aspect. If it doesn't, then what the fuck is it all for? If it's just legal maneuvers to get them out of hot water, and we still see the mushrooming effects of street homelessness, then you would think that the citizenry would be up and all, would be pissed off about
but
it.
But see, that would be your argument in 1994 and in 2002. It's always the argument, you know, what about it, folks? This doesn't do anything real. And their answer is, oh, we're cracking down on bad behavior and an illegal conduct. And they've got these nice cover code phrases that, you know, that essentially justify suggesting that they're, I mean, it's, you know, it's make work for the police department, really, of a sort that's not terribly helpful for, you know.
Yeah.
For,
I mean, my fear is like we're seeing now, if you're not in the streets team, then you're no good. You're not trying to help yourself.
Uh-huh.
And if you're not in the encampment and you're out, then you're just, you deserve whatever you get. That's going to be frightening for me, that they'll be. But I think, again, they need to use the VSPIDAT, this vulnerability index,
to
find the most appropriate person to get in there.
But Brent, let me ask you, because we've gone over this. But what about your bike? Tell us the tale of your errant bike.
So it's funny, you can read about it in that weird daily dump thing that somebody does. You know, the Santa Mierda blog. It's funny that they just use my first name, Brent, homeless advocate Brent.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should just go to one name too.
Chip and Brent.
So I leaned it up at the I think it was a coffee roasting company, actually, and I was having a conversation with somebody, and then the conversation led down the road a little bit as I was drinking coffee, and I just forgot my bike. I sat on a bench with a friend. I do this all the time, every single day practically, and then when it was time to go back, I was like, oh, shit, I forgot my bike, and I went there, and my bike was not there. First thing one should do downtown, if your bike goes missing, is make a beeline for the levee first, look up and down, you don't see it, immediately head to the encampment, because not to assume that anyone there has stolen it, but that's the first place you might look, because there just aren't any other, and then you want to head over to the Harvey West area. And look around. So I went to some key people. I know some people who people will bring. They'll bring stolen bikes to a known dealer. That's somebody who buys an amount of a substance and breaks it into smaller amounts, so that they can actually, you know, feed their own head for no money. And they take some stolen items. But for them, it's not stolen. It's just an item that shows up. Anyway. And so I put the word out on the street, so to speak, and I said goodbye to it, because this is the third time this bike has been stolen, and on this time, it was kind of on me. I know better. I just left it out there, and essentially, if you're a desperate person needing an addictor of drug to get well for the day, my bike is sitting there, just unlocked. It's almost like bait. You know, I hate that. I mean, it's not a bait bike, but it's like, it was just teasing somebody. Also, somebody did steal it. That's fucked up. But so it took a week or so, 6 days. Strangely, the ranger that's been the biggest prick to me lately, Officer Casey Cole, and he's got his own reasons. I'm not saying he doesn't. Gave me a call and said, "We have your bike down here." And I went down there. And Josh, who is one of these characters who, you know, items flow through. He's a good guy. No value judgment there. He had come across the bike. He knew what it looked like, and flagged Officer Cole over to try to find a way to contact me. He called the warming center hotline that we're speaking on now, and I went down there, and there it was, the bike. You know, a little worse for the wear. Some of the special things I had attached to the bike were missing, but I got the bike back. It was truly what I think is really awesome. I think it's a, to one extent, is I think that community, once they identified that that bike was mine, decided not to turn it into, you know, not to strip it or turn it into some commodity, like, let's get it back to him because this guy does a lot of work down here and, you know, try to get his bike back. It was really cool, felt really awesome. Also, I really liked Ranger Cole being involved in that. And he said, you know, I like your work, but I've been told to, but he told me, told by the higher-ups not to interact with me.
Right. Well, what about the two previous seizures of your bike? How did those go?
Same thing. Put the word out on the street. Within a couple days, the street returned the bike. It feels awesome. I mean, that's how you know you're doing good work in the poor community. That if they see your personal belonging out there tumbling around in the black market, they go, oh, this one should go back to this guy. We're not gonna, you know. So somebody ate a little money. That's what I, you know, but on the other hand, here's a weird thing, and I'm not advocating for it. Just, you realize quickly that there is no bike fencing operation in Santa Cruz currently, because a bike can, like this, can sit around on the street for a week rather than making its way into, you know, a larger operation and they're going to truck it down to Los Angeles or something like that. Strangely, and it, that bodes well, also, but it's, I think that the, for the most part, the stolen bike problem that we have is just really hand to mouth. You know, people need to get high immediately. They'll steal a bike. They'll trade it for an amount of something to get them well for the day, and then the bike goes to another person. Either it'll get spray painted, broken down, or, you know, I don't know how they fucking process these bikes. But so far, this bike, which is worth $500. Has been out there floating around and then makes it way back to me, indicating that there's no appropriate fencing operation in Santa Cruz.
Have you had much interaction with with right-wing critics, Brent, you know, from the Santa Mierda, Take Back Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Neighbors side of the street?
Yes and no. I mean, it's funny because that weekly blog Santa Mierda, there's that person Hugh who writes the city council piece at the very end. I actually know who that person is. It's a different gender. You all also know who that person is. Ah. That person sits in city council every week.
No, I think I know
who that is. Yeah, and that person referred to you and I and Keith McHenry as douchebags for speaking negatively about the encampment. Here, the city is finally doing something, and those douchebags, you know, speak negatively. So I emailed the person or whatever, contacted them and said, told them to piss up a rope. You know, I've done a lot of work. And then this week's blog seemed to indicate that conversation. It was kind of adorable in a way that the person admitted to. But no, I have very little interactions in that regard. I'm just really busy now. And this is, you know, peak season for me. I'm running warming centers in two cities, and we're working really hard on establishing the storage program still. We're getting some funding for that in the best way we can by reaching out to some of our previous funders and trying to piece together some things to find out before we reach out to the community for a larger fundraising. And then the connecting the dots program, as you indicated earlier, the survey, intern survey.
How's that survey coming?
Going good. I mean, what's been best about it, we're not anywhere close to the 100 survey subjects, but the effect on the people giving, the interns have been really, this is what I really wanted to see, that they would open up and make some personal discoveries about the nature of street homelessness and see what happens to them when they encounter person after person asking very specific, quite personal questions about their lived experience on the street. And it's been really heartening about what's emerging, about the contacts people are having, and what the projects that they're going to be engaged in soon. We're probably going to open it up now to, I mean, we want to try to keep the cleanest data set possible, so I'm not giving the survey. It doesn't have the word warming center anywhere on the survey. There is a question, like, participated with the streets team? Have you stayed at the winter shelter? Have you stayed at the warming center? But other than that, it does not have our logo or, you know, so ideally it's a very clean survey. But I think we're going to open it up to the warming center volunteer crew so we can get those numbers, because the best data set has, you know, the highest, you know, number of.
Do you include in this questions, have you lost your property by seizure from either authorities or persons unknown? Have you been ticketed or arrested for sleeping?
Citations, specifically about sleeping ban or being in closed areas or, you know,
stay away orders.
Citations, but mainly questions about personal belongings.
Mm-hmm.
How do they store their personal belongings or interact with their personal belongings? Not have you had your. Oh no, there's a question. There's a multiple choice that includes personal belongings.
You know, if you can send me a copy of that, I'd like to see what it looks like.
Sure. Yeah.
I think I sent you Phil Posner's survey from October. Did you get that?
Yes, I did.
And
that's the second time you sent it to me. And that's a little bit more specific towards questions around different types of sheltering needs. And then they also gave, rather than a multiple choice, they gave answers, which makes it really a lot harder to create a data set.
Mm-hmm. Well,
we had many multiple choices that people can answer, one, two, or three multiple choices.
Mm-hmm.
So we can get a little bit of a more specific data set so we can show, you know, some.
What about activism? In other words, you and I have talked about this before, you know, when the, what is likely to be inevitable crackdown, although, you know, I'd love to be wrong, starting in 4 days, or if it hasn't already started, you have suggested that there really doesn't seem to be a lot of leadership to pick up on a kind of a, first they came for a homeless dignity village, protest avenue. And I know this isn't your avenue of choice, but you also noted, you know, you're in a position to see whether these kinds of things, if they do happen, and you're aware that in some instances they've been successful in some cities.
Oh yeah.
Whether it's likely to happen here, particularly since, you know, it doesn't look like they're allowing you to do much in the way of this in terms of any kind of government funding. And they're not even, you know, I guess they're not blocking your proposed mobile storage approach, which sounds...
Not yet.
Not yet, right. But, you know, so in other words, have you had any sense about any sense of change? I know you, as I said, we've talked about this before, your coalition on homelessness here in Santa Cruz to, you know, get a sense of what people...
Santa Cruz, that great activist that we would like to see. For instance, a person named Zav, as we know, other people that we've seen engage with the Freedom Sleepers. There are people who are less protest activists, and they're kind of active, that I would like to see have emerged to have a more clean, less of a, you know, an attack on the city, but more of a constructive device like they did in Santa Rosa, Camp Michaela, which is let's just do an occupy camp that specifically protects this class of people and do a really good job at managing it. Very unlike the sanctuary camp and quite unlike the Freedom Sleepers, which was more of a protest. Like, how do you create something? So we've been calling this Plan B, and I'll give you a little indication of what that could look like. The Occupy movement was mostly successful because it was ubiquitous across the country in 1,500 cities. And so it was a large movement, and so the police department essentially had to literally stand down and just to let it happen because it was a huge movement and a large number of the local residents were engaged. And also city council was interestingly activated by it, for instance, even changing the way that they deal with some of their financial holdings in banks, moving them to smaller banks. But so you'd like to see not just one city do this, because we focus on Santa Cruz too much. Every single city does that. They myopically fixate. But what if you had 5 or 10 cities all doing something together, like a Camp Michaela style organized encampment that had a specific set of agreements for the residents, a way that the thing was going to be established, the type of property that it was going to be located on, and then networked up and down the state with one holistic statement all together. So that's one possibility that could happen that you could make a statement that the state has this crisis. It's not just Santa Cruz, it's not just San Francisco, but the entire state does. And then that would be more pointedly to what is Jerry Brown or the state going to do about this? In terms of the locality, though, when you talk, indicate first they came for the homeless or other cities, Oakland has been successful. Again, Camp Michaela and then other encampments within San Francisco have been successful over a period of time. Santa Cruz in homeless leadership seems to be lacking mainly because you just have so many people using. Some of our favorite people are using addictive substances, and they even with my relationship with them around warming centers or giving them blankets over and over and over, I just don't see much stability where people are not even able to care for themselves very well for too long, let alone provide a strong basis of leadership to establish an encampment. So right away you end up with the one thing you need is strong people taking good care of themselves so they can take care of other people. We're not seeing that in almost any individual out there. I mean, I could be wrong, but over years. So that's what I really want to see if I want to stake my claim in empowering a local community to, you know, homeless community to. What I want to do is, you know, let's start having meetings and encourage people how to do camping better, how to take better care of themselves. But I'm giving some of these people, you know, dozens and dozens of blankets over and over, and they just can't even keep a blanket.
What's the story on the hypothermia deaths? When I was down on Pacific Avenue a couple of days ago, I got reports that there have been 4 hypothermia deaths recently, and I didn't get names, and I don't know how accurate that is. What have you heard?
I haven't heard anything of that. The one they were talking a lot about is, what's his name? CJ, who died in the woods. That was several months ago. But I haven't heard anything. My number is readily available out there. I get calls daily to bring people blankets. Are we open? I'm not getting any word that people are getting hypothermia. Everybody in the encampment can contact me. They know how to get in touch with me. The people on Harvey West area know how to get in touch with me. So I'm not hearing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What I'm doing is delivering a lot of blankets, sometimes as late as 2 in the morning. You know, so.
Anything else we want to go into before I call quits today? We've kind of covered a lot as usual, and I think, frankly, we've covered some new stuff. I think we usually do. We don't just work over the old material. We try to update, I think, but we also get into some new areas. I guess I'll go ask this. You know, there's a growing rent control movement in town.
Yeah.
Any crossover with, I don't expect there will be, but do you see any crossover in terms of activists concerned about either with the groups you're involved with, you know, the Warming Center and the other projects you're doing, and or groups like Food Not Bombs and homeless activists concerned about civil rights for homeless people?
A lot of the volunteers with the Warming Center are definitely active. Some of them are leaders in the rent freeze movement and the new ordinance the petition that's out there to get something on the ballot. So a lot of our volunteers are engaged in that. But in terms of like activist crossover, really, there's something that I mean, people think that they would go hand in hand, but as soon as you start talking about people's need to, you know, around rent, they really, the issues don't meld very well. You think they would. But homelessness always falls off the back of the truck when they're discussing their own needs for lowering rent or people who are, you know, housing insecure. There's something that we have to self-identify, acknowledge about our own classism. When we're talking about our housing, we don't view ourselves as homeless or near homeless. That's a class designation that we would never wear. You would probably never wear it. I've toyed with it. I don't think homeless people should ever consider themselves homeless either, because it's a class designation that they label themselves and demote themselves, you know, in society, and you can almost never get out of it. You almost can never wash that label off. Once, almost always homeless. It's a, you know, it's a caste system almost. Anyway, I wish there were more crossover. Warming Center is bumping along. We're opening a lot more in Watsonville. The team down there is strong. We've seen as many as 30 people in the last few nights each night. Going really well. Also, the Warming Center in Santa Cruz has been very strong. A lot of new volunteers coming in. You can get in touch with us to volunteer at warmingcenterprogram@gmail.com. The hotline is 234-9848.
That's the number we reach
you at. The website is warmingcenterprogram.com. Thank you, Robert.
And Housing Outside in Santa Cruz is still posting videos and interviews?
Oh, yeah, yeah, every day. Charming things on there the last few days. So that's a Facebook page, Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz.
Thank you, Brent.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. And we've been talking with Brent Adams of the Warming Center and other projects aplenty here in Santa Cruz.